It's the Burt Cohen Show. Is made by people. It is never inevitable. I just think, you know, it's up to people to make it. There's always these twists and turns that you never know about. Well, right now, it does look inevitable. Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee appears to be a foregone conclusion, as it did in 2008, when, as you recall, Hillary Clinton was not the Democratic Party nominee. We're going to be talking about the momentum of Hillary Clinton, what the realities are behind the numbers. It looks inevitable now. Our guest today is Guy Saperstein, former civil rights attorney and past president of the Sierra Club Foundation and a board member of Brave New Films. Guy Saperstein, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
I'm glad to be here, Burt.
Saperstein writes that Hillary Clinton may be the most well-known, recognizable candidate, but that is proving to be as much of a burden as a benefit. Well, as we said, Hillary Clinton looked inevitable in 2008. Aside from the attractiveness and organization of her opponent, Barack Obama, what got in the way? What liabilities did she have back then? And to follow up heading into 2016, does she still have those liabilities today?
Well, the answer is yes and no. In 2008, she had very high unfavorables. She was running about 45% unfavorables, which is a historic high for a presidential candidate. She still has that same problem. Her unfavorables today are almost identical. But she had a different problem in 2008. She had voted in favor of the Iraq War in 2003, and that war by 2008 had become extremely unpopular. She refused to recant her vote or to question the vote or the war in Iraq. And I think that was the decisive misstep she took. But it's a characteristic misstep. She's, as I tried to explain in my article, has been a war hawk consistently. So that was totally in character for her. She's never rethought Iraq, never questioned it. So I think she still has, Iraq is not as immediate in the minds of voters. She still has the same problem of being willing to resort to military force early, and I think that's going to be a drag on her this time around as well, because the public is sick of that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of opportunities to get involved militarily. And we will talk about that as the show goes on. And you know, there's always that possibility. And Barack Obama is keeping our troops in Afghanistan for quite a while, calling it Vietnam. That was a previous president. Now we're calling it something else. And
she's got another problem now that she didn't have then. And I think it's a very big problem.
What's that?
It's not necessarily a problem of her own making. And that is that this country is not doing very well. The economy is stagnant. It's not growing. There's high unemployment if you include particularly discouraged workers. Home ownership is under attack. Pensions are declining. It's expensive to go to college. People, when they get rehired, they're not getting the $25 an hour jobs. They're getting worse jobs with fewer benefits. The public is not happy. They're surly, and they're not going to be happy in 2016 either. And she is going to run as the defender of the status quo. And she almost doesn't have any choice. And in fact, if she tried to be the change candidate, she'd look ridiculous. She's been in Washington for 20 years. She represents 20 years of the status quo. And she's stuck with that. And I think that's a very big structural problem for her.
Yes, I would think so. And it's my sense is that, you know, every election, it's either people want change or they want to stay the course. I'd be very, very surprised if by 2016 things got that much better, that people, you know, were ready to vote to stay the course. There was change supposed to happen in 2008, but there's a lot of, it seems like that was marketed to us, but there has been less change than we would hope. What could there be to have people want yet another super insider? I mean, she is just the consummate Washington insider, being, you know, a former first lady, a U.S. senator, secretary of state. What do you think could change to make her resume, aside from being her strong personality, resonate with people who right now seem to want change?
I think she could try, if she wanted to deal with this problem, I think she would start moving in the direction of Elizabeth Warren and, you know, standing with people and criticizing Wall Street and criticizing corporate overreach. But that would require, I think, a complete remaking of who she is. And it's highly unlikely. In fact, quite the contrary is happening. She's giving speeches to Wall Street, being paid $200,000 per speech. She's given two speeches to Goldman Sachs, and she's basically reassuring them that everything's going to be okay. We all got into this mess together, as though you and I, Bert, right there causing the problem.
Right.
We'll all get out of it together. She's not holding them accountable at all. She's doing just the opposite. She's reinforcing her position as defender of the status quo and the ultimate insider. And I think that's a big Achilles heel for her. You know, there's Pew, which does very credible polling, did a polling on the financial industry and found that only 4% of the American public holds Wall Street in high esteem. 43% have no confidence in the financial industry and thinks it has had too much power and been given too many favors. 43%. But she's going to run as a defender of Wall Street. Today, she's the candidate that Wall Street's investing in. And I think that's going to be a serious liability for her.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show about the inevitability of Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee. Our guest is Guy Saperstein, former civil rights attorney, past president of the Sierra Club Foundation, who has written a very thoughtful article about it. And to your knowledge, you talk about Wall Street, the power of Wall Street. They are not favored today. And I can imagine who that 4% is. Probably, you know, that group right around the 1%. To your knowledge, Guy, has Hillary Clinton addressed the wealth gap issue at all? And before you answer that, is this an issue that expect to actually motivate voters in 2016? I rarely see the wealth gap actually bring people out on the streets to come and vote and to make noise. What do you think about that? Has she addressed the wealth gap? Will this be an issue?
You know, I think there's a difference between holding a sign complaining about the wealth gap, you know, having that level of political consciousness, and just understanding that your kids will probably grow up in a worse financial situation than you did. The evidence of a declining America is everywhere. The cost of education is skyrocketing. Public schools are under attack. Pensions are under attack. People, you know, jobs are scarce and hard to get. People understand that. And I think that's going to drag her more so than people that articulate the wealth gap. But the wealth gap and inequality, the 1% versus 99%, is in the public domain. I mean, Occupy made tremendous headway educating America about the difference between 1% and 99%. Thomas Piketty's book is the most talked about book. It's number one on the bestseller list. Everybody's talking about equality. So it is gaining a foothold in the public consciousness. We'll have to see how it plays out. But no matter whether the concept of equality becomes a defining feature of the next race or not, people know that they're sliding backwards, and that's what makes them so unhappy.
Mm-hmm. So she hasn't, as far as you know, Guy Saperstein, she hasn't addressed this particular issue except for reassuring the people who are often seen, generally seen, as causing the problem. Is that correct?
Not to my knowledge, but I have no doubt that in the campaign, she will be full of platitudes about, making the country greater and increasing opportunities for all. Of course, that's the same thing conservatives say. They're always
right.
Opportunities for all. But she'll be, very big on the platitudes. But I think what she's going to have to defend is her husband's record of putting in place many of the structural features that created the inequality we're seeing today. And what am I talking about? Well, number one, getting rid of Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall had been a New Deal reform, which had separated banks from investments. The banks were kind of boring, stodgy things that took money and lent it out for homes, mortgages, and so forth. But when he, and that was required by Glass-Steagall, but when Bob Rubin, Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and Clinton lobbied for the elimination, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, those barriers were removed, and banks became highly speculative ventures, investing in all kinds of things, and as it turned out, it's a lot of very bad investments, and went into the tank, and we all had to pay. We all had to bail them out, Pam. And so anyway, that's part of the Clinton legacy. The other major structural thing that happened in the Clinton administration that we're now paying for is NAFTA. And NAFTA has gutted American manufacturing and led to something like 30,000 manufacturing plants to be moved offshore, and the loss of at least 1 million jobs, their estimates even up to 3 million jobs. And these were manufacturing jobs, good-paying jobs. So that's part, those are the two main structural changes that led to the kind of rampant inequality that we're seeing today. And the Clinton administration was responsible for that.
It's true, and I can't help but think that people will get that, especially when reminded by any Republican that, there's an easy opportunity to show that the policies of Bill Clinton, she's not going to diss her husband. That would be a rather difficult situation. Now I understand she also supports the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership, which could also very badly hurt the American economy. That's not on the average person's radar screen right now, but it could be fairly soon, and there's a reason why it's so secretive. So she is, I believe, on record in support of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, correct?
In support of that, and as Secretary of State, she was pushing it. And the public doesn't quite understand what that is because
right.
It hasn't become a big public issue. However, her base, her Democratic base, and progressive, especially the progressive wing of that base, and labor, they understand how devastating the TPP would be, and she's will be under pressure from them, and this will become a more public issue. Ironically, there are a lot of Republicans and the Libertarian side of the Republican Party that also oppose TPP.
Right.
And it'd be very interesting that, you know, if she had to run against Rand Paul, for example,
right,
would be on the left wing side of that question, and she'd be on the right wing defending it.
Right.
But TPP would really be devastating to American workers, and further the inequality that we've seen develop over the last 20 years.
We are talking about the inevitability, question mark, of Hillary Clinton, what her weaknesses may be. And I thought it was interesting how Karl Rove recently came out and planted the idea that, well, since she had some health issues, maybe she was weak on that. It seems to me that's kind of like what Muhammad Ali used to call rope-a-dope. And you put this out there, and as if that's the only issue they're going to go on. And, of course, we can, you know, Democrats who are, you know, yellow dog Democrats who support any Democrat can say, oh, no, no, she's fine. Meanwhile, they're holding the real fire for after, you know, she is the nominee. I think it's somewhat amusing on that. Now,
well, you know, actually, even before Karl Rove mentioned it, you will find it in my article. And I don't think it's a phony issue. I mean, obviously, Karl Rove, I'm sure, had been two-faced about this. I'm sure when Reagan ran for re-election at an older age than she would be, and
sure,
certainly had his health issues, you know, Karl Rove was pretty silent about that. But there is a real issue underneath that. She had a fainting spell, fell, hit her head. They claimed she was suffering dehydration and fatigue, but she had to be returned to the, she went into the hospital when she fell, and then she, 2 weeks later, had to go back, and they kept her in the hospital, and Bill recently said that it had taken Hillary 6 months to recover. And apparently she had a blood clot in her head, and she had a large blood clot in her leg earlier. You know, these may not be so insubstantial. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to have these kind of, you know, stress-related problems if you're just an average person.
Right.
But running for president is the most brutal thing anybody could ever undertake.
Yeah.
And so she's going to be putting herself under tremendous additional stress. I know she's highly motivated to do it, but, you know, it's not inconceivable that she will rethink, you know, her physical capacities.
Well, I wonder, Guy Saperstein, don't you think, I mean, there's all these Ready for Hillary organizations, there's piles and piles of million-dollar bills just waiting to go into her campaign. If she were not going to run, wouldn't she have told us by now? What's your thought on that?
I think she desperately wants to run. And we should expect that she will run. And I think that she'll run unless her medical issues are, you know, more serious than what's publicly known. So I have no doubt that she's running. I mean, John Podesta, who's, you know, currently in the White House as one of Clinton's, I think he is Clinton's chief of staff, has already told people he's leaving the White House, I think about six months, to work for Hillary. The evidence is all over the place, you know, that she's running.
Well, I want to ask, at this point, you know, her numbers are very, very high. I presume that's because, you know, she's been a familiar face since 1991, thereabouts. But if one looks a little deeper, one finds some worrisome numbers. You wrote about some interesting numbers looking at her versus then a then relatively unknown Chris Christie, before his scandal took him down. Say more about those numbers and you know, that how that plays out for 2016.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, she has been out there, and, of course, her numbers among Democrats are ex- extremely high. I think she's, you know, 55 points ahead of who's ever in number two. Of course, number two is not necessarily running, but she's way ahead. But before Chris Christie had his problem with the bridge stoppage, and that scandal blew up, he was running nationally ahead of Clinton. Now, here's a guy who the public doesn't really know much about. He's a big, fat guy, seems to be moderately likable, and he's got this bipartisan patina. But nobody really knows what he stands for. And out of the blue, he's running ahead of her in national head-to-head polling, you know, with very competent as the Quinnipiac poll.
Yeah, they're a good poll.
That's going to be very, very disturbing. Even today, after his Christie's meltdown and all the criticism he got, in the state of Colorado, there was a recent Quinnipiac poll in Colorado, a very credible poll, and he's tied. And Colorado's a blue state.
Yes,
they've got two Democratic senators and Democratic governor, but it's a competitive state. She's running 42-42 against Christie, and she's running 5 points behind Rand Paul. And nobody really knows that much about Rand Paul.
Right.
I think it should be very disquieting to see that somebody that the public has known so well for so long is running behind these relative newcomers. And I think the big challenge for her will be going up against somebody who sounds, you know, reasonable and moderate, not a hater, and says a few reasonable things, and, you know, offers change, and then criticizes all the things that have gone bad in the country for the last 20 years. That could be a formidable candidate. Now, of course, you can say, would a candidate like that ever emerge from the Republican primaries? And that's a good question. But I have no doubt that mainstream Republicans are working their buns off to come up with a credible candidate, probably not a very well-known candidate, but somebody that sounds moderately reasonable and can offer the patina of change. You know, Jeb Bush, maybe.
Mm.
And that's going to be tough for Hillary.
And it seems also to me that especially in a year when people are likely to look for change, given her 20-plus years, there's a huge paper trail. It just strikes me that there are huge vulnerabilities there. She may be one of our most vulnerable candidates in that they can take so much of her record and make negatives out of it. And that is something that other potential candidates don't have. And what about the Democrats who vote in the primary? You say she's popular with the old boy, old girls network on Wall Street. But how does that play out? What was her relationship with Goldman Sachs in particular? And how is that going to play with the highly participating base, the liberals who tend to vote in a primary? You know, in a Republican primary, it tends to be the right. In a Democratic primary, it tends to be the left. It's a small portion of the general election voting public. What is her relation with Goldman Sachs, and how is that likely to play with the people who vote in a primary?
Well, she has a very close relationship. Of course, Goldman Sachs filled out the Clinton administration's financial positions, and many of those Clinton people were brought into the Obama administration and resulted in steering him toward, complete bailout of Wall Street and not holding them accountable. So, you know, her fingerprints are all over that, and that's not going to be very popular. Now, one of the arguments I made in my article was that on nearly every issue, except women's issues,
right,
Clinton stands to the right of her Democratic base. She does not represent the Democratic base. She doesn't represent the Democratic base on NAFTA, on financial deregulation. She you know, the country is in a very populist mood.
Yes.
Democratic base is in a very populist mood. And she's not. She's a defender of those institutions. She's much more hawkish on foreign policy. She's going to have trouble with her base, and her base will not necessarily vote Republican, but they're
right.
not going to turn out, or they're just not going to bust their buns for her with the same enthusiasm. And that's one thing that happens with Democrats. You know, Democrats, if Democrats voted, they win every election. But the problem is motivation. The Republicans are a smaller base of voters in the country, but they're highly motivated, and they turn out. And I have a real question is how motivated are people going to be for her, given the fact that on policy after policy, she stands substantially to the right of where her followers.
And I tell you, Guy Saperstein, I've been hearing the same thing that, you know, people say, yeah, if she's I expect her to be the nominee. Yeah, I'll vote for her. But that enthusiasm gap is very, very significant. We saw in 2010 when Democrats got our butts handed to us because people were not motivated. It's got to be more than just, yeah, if she's the nominee, I'll support her. That is not going to cut it. And Barack Obama talked about, you know, getting people fired up.
I think the mood of the Democratic base is that, well, she's been around for a long time. It's certainly time for a woman to be president.
Sure.
We're long past the time when a woman should be president. And I do think that Democrats should run a woman. I happen to think it's Elizabeth Warren and not Hillary, but,
right.
but I'm totally behind that. That's her one big strength, that feeling. And she's been there. She's kind of earned it. But I don't feel that big enthusiasm that, wow, she's really going to make things different. She's really going to, you know, push the country forward, and she's going to improve my life. The way people are enthusiastic about Warren. So, yeah, I think there is going to be an enthusiasm gap. And, and when you start off with national polling, which puts you, you know, on parity with, you know, some of these relatively unknown Republicans, you know, I think, you know, she's got to be worried. And those of us who want to have a Democratic president should be worried.
And you point out, Guy Saperstein, that General David Petraeus has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. I don't think this, I mean, she's never walked back from her position in favor of the war against Iraq.
He likes her a lot because when Obama came in, he was there pushing for an expansion and escalation of the war in Afghanistan. And there, in the White House, there were opponents of that, including Joe Biden.
Right.
But Hillary was his strongest supporter. She's been a super hawk on every potential intervention issue, and he appreciated that.
Okay.
And he's spoken very highly of her on that and, you know, other issues. I don't know if he's formally endorsed her for president or not, you know, but he's spoken very highly and said that she would be a very good president.
Mm, well, for him, I'm sure he would.
For him, yeah. For him. But you know, he's the guy that sold Obama on this whole idea of counterinsurgency and an expansion of the commitment to Afghanistan long after the Afghanistan adventure had proved to be counterproductive. He's about the last guy in the world whose advice we should be listening to.
Yeah, I would think. And she, what has Hillary Clinton's position been on Afghanistan? I think the country in general, not just the Democratic base, but the country in general is saying, why are we there? What are we doing? We have to be there now till 2016. What's her position been on Afghanistan as Secretary of State in particular?
Well, she was a big proponent of escalating the war in Afghanistan. She and others, including Obama, have tried to stay in Afghanistan as long as possible. I mean, I think they've been frustrated by Karzai, and they're hoping now that with the new election, the new president will let America stay there probably indefinitely.
Wow.
You know, with a smaller force, I think they're talking about
10,000
military, but then an unnamed number of contractors. Of course, that's the part of the war. They had up to 120,000 soldiers, but they had 100,000 private soldiers, contract soldiers, which were each paying like $120,000 a year for these people. So they're not formal military, but they're functioning like military. So we don't even know whether that's going to continue or how many that's going to be. But there's no question that America wants to stay in Afghanistan for a long time, and she's been a supporter of that.
And what about, if you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Guy Saperstein. We're talking about Hillary Clinton as Democratic nominee, her strengths and weaknesses. Is it inevitable? And what about Syria and Libya, the two rather big hotspots that are not going away exactly? What has Hillary Clinton's position been on those two?
She wanted to invade Libya, and she wanted to bomb Syria. Very quick, military response. Now, fortunately, Obama stepped back from Syria. He may be rethinking that today.
Yeah.
Apparently, they're doing more support of the rebels clandestinely. But, it's a no-win proposition for America because there are no good guys in Syria to support. I mean, you've got a very bad tyrant, Assad, running the government, but then you get a ragtag bunch of people that would normally be considered left-wing terrorists chasing after him and fighting him. And what are we going to do? Are we going to arm these rebels? The rebels right now are demanding they want these shoulder-held anti-aircraft. They need them because they're getting pounded by the Syrian military air force. But you spread a bunch of these kind of weapons over there, and then don't be surprised if one of our airliners someplace gets shot down, by one of these handheld missiles by some terrorist who decides that America's an enemy. So it's dangerous arming these guys. I mean, the Republicans are screaming bloody murder. But of course, the Republicans always do that. And they have a lot more military support. But there's a blowback. The same thing happened, when we armed the Taliban in Afghanistan. We created this Frankenstein.
With the same missiles, the same handheld, oftentimes Stinger missiles.
So I mean, it's very dangerous getting involved in that war, and Obama, to his credit, has been, very cautious about it. Gets beat up by the right wing, but he's been very cautious about it. He managed to resolve the chemical weapon thing peacefully. I mean, got to thank Putin big time for that. But he did resolve that without the military attack. Syria is now moving all chemical weapons.
That's true. And
never, with Hillary, it would have been just deeper into the morass. And she's her instincts are horrible. I mean, like when Russia went in and took over Crimea, which of course it thinks it's part of Russia, but anyway, that's a whole different story. But the Europeans and Obama are trying to use diplomacy and trying to calm him down so he doesn't take over the Ukraine, which Russia, which has historically been part of Russia. Right at the worst moment, when we're trying to use diplomacy and the Europeans are trying to use diplomacy, she publicly calls Putin a Hitler. just about the dumbest, most intemperate thing I've ever seen an American diplomat do. Now he's not a Hitler, so it's a ridiculous comparison, but it was so intemperate, And so, you know, what, and you know, foreign policy and diplomacy is supposed to be her strong suit. So, you know, what kind of trouble is she going to get us into if she were president? I mean, it really scares me.
And I wonder too, you know, how, when she compared Putin to Hitler, how did our allies in Europe react to that?
Well, they were appalled. It was exactly the wrong thing to do. And, you know, they all toned it down. And it seems now we're making a little bit of progress in Ukraine. I mean, Russia pulled back its troops. They had an election. And Ukraine may be moving, you know, closer to the European Union. So, you know, we're making some progress in Ukraine without military intervention. And the thing is, and I do give Obama some credit for this. He's a very cautious president.
Yes.
Hasn't provided near as much change as, you know, we expected. But now he's doing some good things on the foreign policy field. He is talking about non-military methods. I mean, he said if you have a big hammer, which we do, then every problem in the world starts looking like a nail. And of course, that's just not...
Yeah, that was wise of him to say.
So that's good. And he's been very good on Iran. And compare that to Hillary. I mean, Obama comes out with this, you know, very, very promising peace initiative with Iran. And Hillary, who was Secretary of State and did, near as I can tell, nothing to promote peace in Iran, or at least nothing publicly.
Right.
Maybe she did some things in the background we should be giving her credit for, but she hasn't talked about that. But in any case, Obama is pushing for peace in Iran. He's getting attacked by Israel and AIPAC,
right,
in the United States. And there's this terrible bill in the Senate that would add, the Menendez-Kirk bill, that would add sanctions on Iran at exactly the wrong time. Because, you know, we're trying to make peace. It's not the time to be adding sanctions. And Obama had to fight that back and get the Democratic caucus under control. And, you know, she was the last of the Democrats to publicly support Obama. And, in fact, she had to be – I'm involved in this issue a little bit myself, so I know a little bit of the background of it. The peace side – of this is the Obama supporters had to use Madeleine Albright to lobby Hillary. Now, Madeleine Albright is the most hawkish Secretary of State in American history. Colin Powell's chief of staff once said of Madeleine Albright, she never met an intervention she didn't want to, you know, send the military into. And, you know, if you have Madeleine Albright lobbying Hillary to support the peace process, well, what does that say?
Wow. That is pretty amazing. And, you know, somehow people think of Hillary as progressive. They sort of assume that. And she is on reproductive issues, women's issues. But I don't see what else. And she was Secretary of State a long time. I see, quite frankly, John Kerry being a lot more active when it comes to negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians and with Iran. Does she have a particularly great record that she can be proud of, accomplishments as Secretary of State?
Well, if she does, none of us know what they are.
And what about...
And you know, when she's asked this question... I criticized her for lack of accomplishments, but when I before I actually wrote it up, I went into the internet and I kept, you know, punching out Hillary Clinton foreign policy accomplishments as Secretary of State, everything I've come up with. Well, there's almost nothing out there, and I finally found one article written by a woman for Time magazine, okay, well-funded magazine.
Research
and so forth. And it was a joke. I mean, it was just appalling, you know, what this woman had dug up. And it's basically the same thing that Hillary always says. Hillary will always tell you how many countries she's visited.
Uh-huh.
And how many miles she's traveled. Well, there's no question in my mind that she's a very competent, very smart, very hardworking person who in most cases, reads her briefing books, does her homework, is always prepared, shows up for meetings, always prepared. And she travels a lot, and it's hard work. Give her credit for all. You know, she's got great work habits. I give her credit for that. But at some point, you know, when somebody's been in the public domain for 20-plus years, you got to ask them, well, okay, what did you accomplish? So what did she accomplish in Secretary of State? You know, she had great leverage on Israelis because she's got very close relations both to Israelis and AIPAC in the United States.
Right.
Did she use that to, you know, promote the peace process in with Palestine? Not a bit. Or at least if she did, nobody saw any of it.
Well, and
while the Israelis became more aggressive in
more belligerent, yeah,
settlements on the West Bank, you know, so there's no evidence that she had any positive impact there. Did she have any impact on Iran? Well, if she did, none of us saw it. But as soon as John Kerry came in, you know, he's in the Middle East trying to restart the peace talks with Palestine,
right,
and Israel, and then they come up with this proposed deal with Iran, which is the most promising thing that's happened out there in 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, right out of the box. So, you know, I'm sure she's going to be asked, but she has been asked, and she doesn't have a hell of a lot to say.
And what about,
you know, at some point you got to look at, you know, what's accomplished, not just work habits.
Yeah, really. What do you have to show for yourself at the end of the day? AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, is a very, very powerful lobby in Washington. They basically, I don't think I'm exaggerating,
probably the most powerful lobby.
Right. And it's like, I don't think I'm exaggerating saying that the AIPAC position is Israel can do no wrong. Israel can do no wrong whatsoever, no matter what, how right-wing, how militaristic, they can do no wrong. How is that going to play out in the general electorate and in the with the primary voters, assuming, well, if she doesn't have a primary, then I guess, you know, she's it. But talk about a bit about her relationship with them. I mean, they're not there's a new group, J Street, which is very much unquestionably pro-Israel, but they want, you know, to move back from the hard right, super militaristic, you know, almost apartheid. I mean, at least John Kerry actually said the word apartheid. I'm sure he knew what he was doing, and then he walked it back. But Hillary and AIPAC, are they particularly close, or what's her relationship with them?
Oh, she's their favorite. She's very, very tight with AIPAC, and they, you know, will provide her, I'm sure, with a lot of money, AIPAC supporters.
Yeah. Tremendous money.
You know, I don't really think that you know, general voters, you know, vote on things like,
right,
our foreign policy in Israel. I do think there is a small community. I'm personally involved in J Street and am on the J Street side of that equation. But you know, there is a small community of Jewish voters that do pay close attention to this stuff, you know, there is a disagreement within the Jewish community. But, you know, what you said is exactly correct. AIPAC doesn't represent American Jews. It represents the Israeli government. And they will support anything.
Anything.
You know, no matter how right-wing. And even the liberals. I mean, I have a very, very, very good friend, a just absolutely wonderful person, who the two-time past AIPAC president. And she's just a wonderful person, very liberal on everything. So there are really great liberals in AIPAC, but they've got their marching orders. They don't challenge the Israeli government. Now, what's different about J Street is J Street actually is trying to represent the political sentiments of the American Jewish community.
Right. Big difference.
American Jewish community is not so militaristic and aggressive, and they do recognize that the only future for Israel is a two-state solution, and the Palestinians have rights too.
Right.
So J Street is gaining a real foothold,
yeah,
because they actually with American Jews, because they actually speak for American Jews, not the Israeli government.
Yes, and there is a difference.
Kind of a developing sub-drama. which is, you know, quite interesting.
Well, one thing that American Democratic primary voters do care about is the environment. That seems to be very, you know, pretty high on the radar. Hillary Clinton's Department of State is on record in support of the horrendous, highly controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Is her position in support of the Keystone XL pipeline in line with those people who are likely to vote? And I think this is a serious weakness on her part, is it not?
I think it should be a serious weakness. I know there are a lot of supporters of Hillary that are very distressed by the fact that she not only, her State Department supported it, but she also had the State Department hired a company to do an analysis of Keystone that had conflicts and ties with the pipeline company itself. Now, she's been queried on this many times and has refused to take a position. There was just a letter that was sent, I think, on Monday, a letter was sent from about 20 environmental groups asking very politely for her to take a position on Keystone. And she, you know, she hasn't done it, even though presumably she knows a lot about it. And she has made some general references to, you know, job creation by Keystone, but
right.
when you look at, you know, very few jobs, there'd be some construction jobs, a few thousand construction jobs created, which will last about a year. And then there's going to be only 35 permanent jobs. So it's not a job creator. I mean, by comparison, the solar industry, which represents only 1% of power in America, has created, in the last 3 years, 144,000 jobs. So, you know, if you're really looking at jobs, I mean, there are much better ways to create jobs in America, and you can do it with clean, sustainable power. And she hasn't taken a position on any of that. Same thing with fracking. You know, she has taken no position, a public position, on fracking. And by the way, most people don't know this, but most of the fracked gas being dug out in America is being shipped overseas.
Right.
In fact, I just came back from Colorado. I've got a ranch out in Colorado. Just came back from Colorado, and I saw a film out there about fracking called "Dear Governor Hickenlooper," and. So I asked the guy who made the film, how much of this gas that's being fracked in Colorado? There are 52,000 wells out in Colorado dug in the last 3 years. How much of this gas is staying in the United States? And he says to me, well, we don't know for sure, but very little. We do know, get this, 45% of all the fracking wells dug in Colorado have been dug by the China Energy Department.
Oh, my.
The China Energy Department. Okay, and it's the same thing with Keystone.
Yes.
All that oil is going to China.
All of it.
None of it is going to stay in the United States.
Right.
We are basically being plundered like a third world country, and it's all for profits. You know, it has very little to do with jobs and has nothing to do with energy independence.
No.
He's taken no position on any of that.
Amazing. I got to ask, there's a few other things. We don't have that much time left, but NSA spying, it seems to me that can create possibly some strong new alliances between the right and the left, which are really concerned about NSA spying. Has Hillary said anything about that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Boy.
And you're right, it is an interesting dynamic because, you know, the libertarians are
absolutely
more upset about it than the Democrats.
Well, than most, you know, mainstream.
Most Democrats, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what about Hillary's famous vindictiveness? And she has this enemies list, which has been written about. Some have called her, and I suppose this may be a little sexist, I don't know, but they've called her Nixon in a pantsuit. Is that fair? What do we know about her vindictiveness and her enemies list?
Oh, there's no question about it that, you know, they try to breed intimidation and fear. I notice it even in, I travel in progressive circles, but I even notice it there, that there's a real fear of stepping out and speaking against the Clintons because every wants a piece of the action. And of course, a lot of people, you know, believe in her too. I don't deny that. But you know, a lot of people want a piece of the action. They want to have access, and they don't like to become, you know, the skunk at the party. And the Clintons promote that. So you know, I mean, you know, that's hardball politics. I mean, they're not the only people that know how to play hardball politics. They do it, you know, well. And to be honest with you, I don't really hold that against them that much. But it is a fact. And the other fact is that people like to go with the winner.
Yes, that's for sure.
You know, people. You know, they're just not that many people that want to step out and you know, piss on the shoes of the eventual winner.
Yeah, that's a colorful picture you paint there, Guy Saperstein. Now there are others. People say, well, if she doesn't run, who is going to run? Well, there's Joe Biden, Maryland Governor O'Malley, former Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, and of course Bernie Sanders, who is very, very likely to run. I certainly hope it's as a Democrat. The fact that these guys are all pretty much unknown, how much does that matter at this point?
Well, I don't think you could say Biden's unknown.
Right, aside from him.
But I think you could say he's uninspiring. Even though, I you know, like in foreign policy, I think he's been a calming influence and a good influence in the administration. He was the one who questioned the escalation in Afghanistan very strongly. And, of course, time proved him right. So I give him a lot of credit. And, you know, Obama's been moving in a more peaceful direction, and you know, I'm willing to give Biden some credit for that.
Just,
I don't think that Biden's a bad guy or anything, but he's also has had a lot of stumbles, you know, on the campaign trail.
But what about just in terms of political dynamics? The fact that these guys are pretty much unknown, Schweitzer and O'Malley, and even Bernie Sanders, does that matter at this point?
No, I don't think it does. In fact, I think newness and freshness is an advantage. And I don't know that much about. I mean, I don't know that much about O'Malley, although people have spoken very highly of him.
He's a good speaker.
And Schweitzer is a very interesting character. I'm not sure he would run. He's also got a real commitment to coal. Of course, he comes from a coal state. But I think that, you know, the idea of an independent, fresh new governor. Who could kind of ride on a plain slate, you know, could be very, very, very attractive. I think any man running against Hillary is going to face some headwinds, because I think it is generally felt, and by the way, I agree with this sentiment, you know, that it's time for the woman.
Yeah.
And
so that points to Elizabeth Warren, who. No question, Wall Street does not favor her. And she says she's not running now. But I wonder if in 2014, if the Senate tilts Republican, do you think that might make her decide to run because she'd be, frankly, less effective there?
Well, in my article, I suggested that might make her rethink not running. Of course, I don't necessarily want that to happen.
No, of course not.
The Senate, just so she might run.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she might rethink that. She might also rethink, you know, her age. She's going to be 67 on Election Day 2016, and if she doesn't run in 2016, you know, she can't just wait eight years through two terms of a Republican president or a Democrat president and run at 75. That's probably too old for the American public to accept. So, you know, this may be her only chance, even though she's relatively new on the scene.
Well, so was Obama.
But so was Obama, and Obama, you know, excited the Democratic base Elizabeth. I think the difference is Elizabeth Warren actually has a track record. I mean, she's been in the pits in the administration fighting these banks, fighting the good fight, you know, against the Clinton economic team, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, and she's got the scars. You know, and she didn't back down. I mean, she fought and fought and fought, and then she finally, and she got her Consumer Protection Agency, which is an achievement, and then she ran for the Senate, and she's fighting now. So there's not a lot of back down on her. So she does have a, the kind of track record and the toughness that I think Obama lacked. So I think she's got the goods, and I think she could be a very formidable candidate. And the other thing is, if she decided to run, number one, she could raise a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Raise $45 million in her kind of campaign. And I know lots of donors that would love to give her $1 million. But the other thing is, the media would like to see a contest.
Yes.
Like conflict. Conflict sells newspapers.
Absolutely.
And if she ran, she'd immediately get $100 million worth of free advertising, you know, telling her
drama
story.
Yep.
But she could be very competitive, very fast.
And I think it's fair to say nothing is inevitable in politics. Guy Saperstein, if people are interested in reading more of what you have to say, where can you point them?
Well, I would point them to my article in Alternet.
Yes.
Alternet and my name, Guy Saperstein, and you come up with a variety of articles, but this was is one of them.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll see if this train might be able to be stopped at this point. Guy Saperstein, thanks so much for being on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Hey, thanks, Burt.
Stop that train, I'm leaving any day now. Stop.